Welcome to Private Equity Perspectives, a podcast by BDO USA's private equity practice. Each episode, BDO connects with leaders in the private equity space to discuss the latest trends driving deal activity, fund strategies, and portfolio company optimization.
Hello, and welcome to BDO's Private Equity Perspectives podcast, where we explore the trends impacting private equity today. I'm Todd Kinney, National Relationship Director in BDO's private equity practice. Today, we have the privilege of being joined by Nicholas Vega Yona, who is a principal at Lincolnshire, and Monty York, who's a managing partner at GenX360. In this episode, Nico and Monty will discuss how 2025 unfolded differently than really many anticipated, how portfolio companies performed against expectations, and each of their outlooks for deal flow and valuations heading into 2026. In our next episode, which will be part B of our conversation with Nico and Monty, we'll explore exit strategies, creative deal structures, and where they believe smart money will focus in the year ahead. Now, just a quick reminder to our listeners that the remarks and opinions of our guests do not necessarily represent BDO's views. So with that out of the way, Nico, I'm going to have you kick off the episode. Maybe you can start by walking our listeners through your current role as a principal at Lincolnshire, where you serve on both the execution and diligence and portfolio monitoring teams, and also feel free to share a bit about your firm's investment focus and what makes the firm's value proposition unique. Also, if we have time, I'd be interested to hear your experience working in Latin American markets and how that cross-border perspective influences your approach to deals today. There's a lot there, so take it in any order.
Great. Thank you, Todd. Happy to be here. In my current role, I act as a deal lead under the co-heads of execution who sit in our investment committee. I will coordinate with one or the other as we move through diligence. This includes developing the analysis materials. For that, I'll usually lean on more junior members of the firm, engage and negotiate terms with lenders, and finally engage, review, and try and help lead all third-party work in the form of, you know, Q of E, IT diligence, legal diligence, and so on and so forth. Once we own the company, I'll be involved in monitoring it. So this includes sitting on the board of the companies we've acquired, as well as leading the weekly monitoring effort, which is a call where we review a few of the KPIs that we uncovered under diligence that we've sort of pre-agreed to with management so that they can put some form of one pager together. It's great because we get a general update of the business on a weekly basis. And it's also a great forum for management to bring up initiatives that they are thinking about, like CapEx investments, team build out, commercial efforts. We track to act as a smart sounding board, and from time to time will help with preparing payback analysis for board approval. Of course, you have to make yourself available once you own these companies to talk to management anytime that they need. So very early on in the relationship, I would say going back to the diligence process, with the permission, of course, of bankers, we like to develop texting relationships with the members of the C-suite. I'll talk a little bit about my LATAM experience because I think it's a nice pivot into why Lincolnshire was such a nice fit. So in LATAM, I worked both in an investment bank focused on cross-border transactions and then as the financial director and head of business development at a family-run corporation with multiple business units. And what I've learned between those two is that family-owned businesses of a certain size are very similar from one region to another. So they will usually have a lack of a very robust FP&A capability. Growth that they've experienced recently has led to an unorganized balance sheet. And, you know, the companies that I was looking at either in banking or opportunities that we wanted to acquire from this family group were usually ones that had a lot of appetite for future growth. And so they needed to grow in a way that was maybe more orderly and monitored better in a sense. So the focus at Lincolnshire was sort of a nice fit for me, given that Lincolnshire's focus is to acquire companies that we can help optimize. And usually those come in the form of us being the first institutional capital in. So here we invest in three large buckets, and then I'll go back and explain a little bit more of what we do with that horizontal theme of optimization. But the three large Lincolnshire buckets are business-to-business products and services. So anything where the customer is an institution doing some analysis before purchasing your product or service versus someone else's, we like to focus on companies and segments where price is not a number one or number two purchase decision driver, but rather the purchase decision is more weighted towards things like quality, reliability, customer service, and on-time performance. Second large bucket is niche manufacturing and industrials. So companies that have a physical footprint where some form of value add takes place, whether it's end-to-end manufacturing, assembly, or even pick and packing. And we think that this is very on trend with the continuous onshoring and nearshoring happening in the US and more widely in North America. Here we like companies that are part of either a design for manufacturing process or that are a mission critical part of the value chain and have very high switching costs. The third large bucket that we've dubbed enthusiast consumer is basically B2C or B2B2C companies where the purchase decision at the consumer end is less analytical and more emotional. So historically for us, those have been companies that are either in the sports or hobbies categories. We've owned tennis racket company, scuba diving certification company. We currently own a fully customized baseball glove company. And we're currently looking to tag on investments in wellness and pet because we see the same more emotional, less analytical purchase decisions as people look to care for themselves, their families, their pets. Now, back to the horizontal theme, the companies that we acquire are usually great at doing what they do, but not necessarily great at measuring what they do. So our value proposition is basically to help roll out the necessary tools and capabilities, including a financial lead when necessary, which will allow management to collect data, analyze actionable numbers, and use those insights to make informed decisions about the business, whether having to do with the operation, commercial efforts, or new investments, which from time to time will include add-ons. So at Lincolnshear, we have both dedicated resources for originations and operations. So once we own the company, we'll rope in those teams as needed. Originations, with management's and the execution team's guidance, will find us actionable add-on opportunities, while operations will serve as an additional resource for things like software rollouts in the form of ERPs and CRMs usually. So the general playbook is to allow management to focus on organic growth while we look to drive professionalization of reporting and sourcing creative add-ons.
All right, Nico, a lot of information there. I appreciate all the background. So Monty, I'll give you the same chance to share some of your overview and background. So with over two decades in PE and now serving as managing partner at GenX360, where you chair several portfolio companies, the new deal review committee, and sit on both the valuation investment committees, you certainly bring a wealth of experience to the podcast today. So can you take us through your career trajectory? What led you to your current role at GenX360 and what that entails? And would also love to hear about your firm's investment approach and what you see as your firm's unique value proposition in the current landscape.
Thanks, Todd. Appreciate the opportunity
You
to
bet.
Be part of the podcast. And also, Nico, great to work with you. So my background, I started out probably consistent with most people that are in private equity on the investment banking side, transitioned into private equity, and ultimately ended up at GenX360 in 2009. What got me excited about GenX360 was really our unique operating angle. The firm was founded by four individuals, three of them with very deep operating experience, and have been with the firm since then. I've been a managing partner since then, and we've had a great ride. We're now $2.5 billion in assets under management. We're currently investing our current fund of about $800 million. And our focus is, I think, somewhat consistent with Nico. It's lower middle market companies, probably 5 to 15 million in EBITDA. It's frankly where we see the greatest opportunity to drive value creation. And our strategy is, as I think, quite simple, but quite effective. We have an operating angle and a deep operating team within the organization that we leverage. We target the industrial services and business services sectors, where we think there's the greatest stability, greatest demand profile, and also significant fragmentation. And the reason that fragmentation is relevant is because we have a very proactive sourcing model followed up by an aggressive buy and build strategy. And the fragmentation is critical for us to identify opportunities to invest as platforms. and that fragmentation is critical to executing the buy and build strategy. The operating team really comes into play as you think about the buy and build strategy and how critical it is to not just buy good businesses, but to integrate good businesses. So we as a firm, we've now done over 30 platform investments, over 80, 90 add-on acquisitions, and having successful top quartile performance for the last two funds, and having fun really partnering with management teams and working with them to create industry-leading companies.
All right, Monty, really appreciate that background. So now that the audience knows a little bit about both of you, let's jump into the discussion. So I think it's fair to say that 2025 went differently than originally anticipated for many PE firms. When you guys reflect on the past 12 months, what stands out as the biggest shift in private equity? Nico, why don't you get us started here?
Sure. I echo your comment that 2025 has been a very particular year for private equity.
Right.
We had macro factors like tariff-driven uncertainty. We had persistent core inflation still hovering around 2.8%. This, of course, created challenges for a lot of businesses that were looking to come to market in 2025. And this, ultimately resulted in a much slower clip of quality, lower mid-market platforms hitting the market this year. Meanwhile, access to debt financing actually increased significantly due to the proliferation of potential credit partners. So while finding platforms was challenging, the increased competition on the credit side of the equation allowed for competitive lender auctions on new deals and on refinancings. In the midst of all this, Lincoln Shear was able to find a platform brokered by a smaller advisor in a limited process that we closed during Q1 of this year. That business checked a lot of boxes for us in the niche manufacturing and B2B2C buckets. We were able to maintain price discipline while acquiring an asset with a strong management team that could benefit from additional capabilities that we could help implement, as explained before. So then throughout the year, the auction pipeline actually started picking up in the term of the number of deals. However, the few companies that we thought were platform-level quality in our size range from auctions were trading away from us at multiples that even at a full underwrite of management projections would still not generate our target returns. So we decided to remain relentlessly disciplined on pricing during these auction processes, and we started looking for some direct opportunities. And there, our team was able to identify a trend in light industrial staffing and backed a talented management team in a smaller company that can significantly benefit from the Lincoln Shear customer network across other platforms. So that deal was sourced directly as part of a strategy to try and avoid some of those more competitive auctions.
All right. Very interesting. Appreciate the perspective. So, Monty, I guess, how would you answer that question? When you look back at 2025, what stands out to you as the biggest shift in private equity?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all went into 2025 expecting it to be a boom year in terms of acquisitions,
Yep.
and it certainly didn't end up there. It has been an interesting year, and if you think about the types of industries and businesses that ended up having more robust markets, certainly some challenges in the more capital equipment heavy businesses where people have deferred their capital expenditures. But there are areas of opportunity, and fortunately for us, we focus in the services in arena, which although less robust, we still have lots of opportunity. The proactive sourcing model helps immensely in difficult environments like this. And as a result, we were able to execute on really three different platforms as new investments in this environment, all sourced through our proactive model. That helps a lot. At the same time, from an exit perspective, it was, generally a difficult environment for anybody. And the only assets that we're really selling are those that are what you would call the Class A type assets. Fortunately for us, we do have one of those that we're able to sell at a very attractive exit multiple in return for the investors. But I believe that, some of the challenges of 2025, such as the one I mentioned on capital equipment and tariffs and all that, I believe as we roll into the next year, we're hopeful that there's going to be a different story and that the markets will open up and be more robust.
Yep, let's hope. But I think three new platforms is pretty impressive given the year. So congrats on that. But let me shift gears now. I want to discuss portfolio performance. How have your portcos been performing relative to expectations? And I guess the second part is, are there particular operational levers or cost management strategies that became more important in 2025 about Monty, you kick us off on this one.
Yes, great question. And I think it's
Yeah.
somewhat dependent on the company and where that company resides, what's it doing and what's it offering to the market. On the capital equipment side, as I mentioned, there's a slowdown on the capital equipment purchases, which results in, I think, greater discipline requirements for the portfolio company, better abilities to procure, recognizing that your sources are going to have to change and you're going to have to be focused more on US-based sourcing providers. On the services side, majority of the services we have are really US-focused. And in those circumstances, those businesses have performed well. It's one of the reasons we target services is they have weathered the storm well and weathered different market challenges very well. I think the focus for us is with our operating team is really driving around the go-to-market strategy, continuing to enhance and improve upon that and working closely to continue to optimize the overall business. It's interesting, Nico used that term, and it's a term that we use as a firm as well. It's really optimizing the companies that we invest in as we partner with the management teams.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the perspective. So, Nico, I'm going to come back to you in Lincolnshire. How have your portcos performed relative to expectations? And again, what operational levers became more critical this year?
Yeah, so I would echo what Monty pointed out, that the challenge here was more so in manufacturing operations than services companies. So focusing on manufacturing, our portfolio companies were actually exceptionally resilient this year despite that trade uncertainty and inflation. That being said, 2025's most common challenges in these portcos were labor availability, raw material procurement, and just general commercial uncertainty that was due to the tariff war going on. So just further digging into those three and how the portcos were able to address those. Firstly, we did see an improvement in our labor markets from the extreme tightness at the beginning of the year that had resulted from the government's COVID and dividend policy. This ultimately improved lead times and therefore generated an uptick in revenue and cash flow as the year progressed. But at the beginning of the year, during the tighter times, our companies were implementing employee reference programs, which we found worked quite well, not just to get heads in the door, but also to improve retention, as these individuals had existing relationships with whomever was referring them. And so that would generally indicate a better cultural fit. Secondly, on the procurement of raw materials, those affected by tariffs were obviously challenging, but industry-wide. So although it did momentarily affect performance again this earlier in the year, it wasn't like we had competitors gaining ground on us. And to our management team's credit, they leaned on their customer service capabilities to clearly communicate the issue to key channel partners and customers, and were able to pick up business sort of as soon as those inputs became available again. Finally, and one that sort of sorted out itself, was on the demand side. In the beginning of Q2, there was a general uncertainty driving out customary ordering patterns from customers across different industries. Those ordering patterns have since normalized to the point that we actually have two of our manufacturing companies started to staff a third shift to keep up with rising demand as the year comes to an end and early into next year. So that's definitely looking a lot better.
All right. Well, thanks, Nico. Certainly a lot of good insight from both of you on that topic. Listeners, we're actually going to press pause on this discussion for the time being, but we're going to be back in a couple of weeks to talk more with Nico and Monty. In part B there, we're going to cover deal flow expectations, valuation outlooks, exit strategies, and where smart money is focusing in 2026. A special thanks to Nico and Monty. We appreciate you taking time to go on the podcast today. I know you're both super busy, and I'm looking forward to hearing more from both of you.
Yeah, Todd, thank you for having me, Monty. It's been a pleasure, and I'm really looking forward to part two here.
Yep.
Same here, Todd. Really enjoyed it, Nico. It's been a lot of fun.
All right, guys. To our listeners, thanks so much for tuning in. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and leave a review of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been BDO's Private Equity Perspectives.
The views presented by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of their respective firms.